Welcome to the second episode of this little experiment that I'm doing in the podcast, which is, as a reminder, I'm looking at all of 1984 quite quickly, so in 3 one-hour episodes, using the three-part structure of the book as my guiding sort of motif. In the last episode, I looked at part one. In this episode, I'll look at part two, which is the long central stretch of the book. And I'd already said in the previous episode that the first part of the novel is where a lot of Orwell's world building occurs and where we learn a great deal about the society of Oceania, Winston's place in it, what exactly he's up against as someone profoundly dissatisfied with that world. Here, though, we learn more. And we learn more in new ways. So one of the most obviously new ways in which we learn more about Oceania is in that very long stretch devoted to Winston reading from Goldstein's book, from The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism, which is a bit of the book that students, and I imagine many other readers, tend to skip. Or start reading and then give up on, or read and are uncertain what to do with or about. And this is understandable. I mean, certainly when I first encountered Orwell, when I was reading this book for the first time, I had very little sense of why this bit of the book was in the novel, and why Orwell devotes so much time to it. I now strongly encourage students always not to skip it, for several reasons. One, if you do skip it, you are missing out on a great deal of information about the world of 1984. There's a great deal of world building done in the book. The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism, the extracts of it that we have available to us as readers of 1984. So you miss out on a great deal of information if you skip it. I think also you miss out on a few other things. One, you miss out, and this is a spoiler if you haven't read the novel, I'm assuming everybody has for this sequence of episodes. If you skip it, you miss out on the payoff, which is that later in the book, we are alerted to the fact that O'Brien wrote, or at least through some version of committee, that's what he says, that he wrote, or was responsible at least in part for writing, Goldstein's book. And therefore, profound doubt is thrown, you know, immense doubt is thrown, and uncertainty is thrown over the status of the information that is in the extracts from Goldstein's book, which we can read. And so I spoke already in the previous episode about the difficulty of knowing on Winston's part, but also on a reader's part, what has happened and when in the development of Oceania. This, what seems to be like a very sort of secure and steady guide to the history and the formation of Oceania, when that is thrown into doubt, we are left even more unanchored, even more sort of discombobulated and thrown onto our own resources into thinking about what we can trust, who we can trust, and why we can trust whatever it is that we choose to acknowledge as trustworthy in the book. And there's very little of that, ultimately. There is very little that is to be trusted. In a sense, the only thing that you can trust for sure is what the narrator tells us. And although that sounds like a very obvious thing to say, it provides some grounds of certainty, even if it's only certainty about uncertainty. So one of the things that we can be very sure about in 1984 is that people are unsure about a lot of things. And that's not just to indulge in some sort of tedious wordplay for the sake of sounding clever or something. It's I think, true to what the novel is trying to do, which is to orientate us to a sense of uncertainty in a way that we can rely on. So we know, you know, so, I mean, think of a different way of writing the novel. Orwell could have chosen to do something he rarely did, which was to write from a first-person point of view. If you're interested, check out his novel Coming Up for Air, published 1939, so a decade earlier. There's lots of connections between Coming Up for Air and 1984. But one of the major differences between them is the fact of the narrator's standpoint. In Coming Up for Air, it's a first-person point of view, and it's not as if the narrator is untrustworthy, but we certainly have only to go on what the narrator tells us. George Bowling, the narrator, there in that novel. Here in 1984, we are often shown things from the perspective of Winston Smith, very closely from his angle of view or vision. But nevertheless, there is, in principle, a difference and a distance between Winston and the narrator. I've already alluded to this on a few occasions in the previous episode. For example, when I was talking about Winston waking up with the word Shakespeare on his lips, and then also later on when we are shown Winston inventing in the Ministry of Truth the war hero Comrade Ogilvy, who would exist in history as sure. Let me just find the bit. It's around about page 80 in my edition. No, maybe a bit earlier than that. Maybe around about, hang on, let me find it. Where is it? Here we go. Page 50 in my edition. Comrade Ogilvy, who had never existed in the present, now existed in the past. And when once the act of forgery was forgotten, he would exist just as authentically and upon the same evidence as Charlemagne or Julius Caesar. One of the things that is happening there is that Orwell is suggesting that we often have a very suspect confidence in the authenticity of our historical information. So there's overwhelming evidence to suggest and to prove that Julius Caesar was a real historical personage who existed, had a life and did important things in the history of Europe and the world. But our access to that information is vulnerable to interference. And that's one of the things that 1984 shows very effectively. Anyway, we'll come back to Goldstein's book in a moment. So, where are we? We are at the beginning of part two, chapter one. And it begins, as Orwell likes to do with these things, he likes to throw in something a little bit, you know, mildly disgusting. It was the middle of the morning, and Winston had left his cubicle to go to the lavatory. So he's got up, he's gone to, you know, do his business in the toilet. And something that is worth pointing out is that sort of thinking about bellies and belly movements, although this might be a bit disgusting, is actually something that crops up a great deal in the book. There's often a lot of attention paid to Winston's stomach and his belly and the pains and the feelings therein. And although at times this is a source of resistance, so he feels something is wrong with the world instinctively in his gut, at other times it's a sign of how tormented he is and traumatized and sort of thrown into pain, physical pain, by what people do to him. So he's doing this, he's walking towards the toilet, and he sees the girl with the dark hair coming towards him. And of course, this is Winston. And she has what looks to be like a broken arm. Her right arm is in a sling, and she falls over and she trips and she hurts her arm, and she cries out in pain. And he picks her up and says, "You know, are you okay?" And she says, "Yes." And then as they separate, Winston realizes that she has slipped him a piece of paper in his hand, secretly slipped him a piece of paper. And he does not look at it immediately because he knows that wherever he looks at things, he will be under suspicion. The safest place to look at the piece of paper is in his office as such, in the cubicle in which he does his work for the Ministry of Truth, because there he is expected to be looking at pieces of paper that he's going to correct. So it's a safe, in inverted commas, you know, as safe a place as any he could find to look at it. He looks at it and he sees written on that piece of paper, "I love you." And this is a great moment, I think, to talk about how Orwell quite subtly but significantly plays with the appearance of information on the page. If you look at that section in the book, in your copy, you'll see that it's offset. So it's a sort of, it's as if it's a quote. It's offset from the rest of the page. "On it was written, on the piece of paper was written in a large, unformed handwriting, 'I love you.'" So it really carries the weight of unexpectedness and deep meaning that such words carry in a society where you are not allowed to say this. You are only allowed to say, or to think, or be seen to be saying and thinking, that you love Big Brother. Any other kind of love is a travesty, is treason, and is traitorous, is to be rejected and to be destroyed. And this is, in consequence, as a gesture, as a way of doing something that stands apart from that, it's both very risky and at the same time powerful, because it's cutting through all the rhetoric and ideological posturing of Oceania to cut through to something more human, more immediately meaningful. Winston finds it incredibly difficult to carry on working, having read this, and he, in a sense, the way that he tries to cope with it is to just get on with his work. He wants to just carry on. But of course, he can't just carry on, because he feels a connection with Julia when he first sees her earlier in the novel. He dreams about her. You remember that moment that I spoke about in the last episode, where he dreams of her casting aside her uniform and annihilating a whole culture with the gesture. So he is sort of unstoppably attracted to her. And the novel says that for a week after their encounter, life was like a restless dream. Something that's very important to do, I think, in thinking about this book, in reading it, is to pay attention to how often dreams are emphasized. It's a dystopia. 1984 is a dystopia, but it's also a dream novel. It's a novel about people dreaming and what that might mean, but also the scenario of the novel itself is suggested to be kind of dreamlike. And we might withdraw for a moment from this sort of detail to think about Orwell's intentions in writing the novel. It's very often suggested that Orwell's intention was to be a kind of futurologist, to predict the future, to say what the future was going to be like, and that his view of the future was a very negative and pessimistic one, in which human freedom, as we know, has been annihilated, and, you know, liberties of all kinds have been curtailed, if not completely destroyed. There is, of course, this in the novel, but it's Orwell never really talks about the novel in terms of predicting things. He talks about it as more in the language of a kind of utopian novel. So not even a dystopia. He calls it a utopia, or a sort of utopia gone wrong. And he's putting himself in the tradition there of, well, one very clear example of a tradition that he's putting himself in is the influence exerted on his work by H.G. Wells. Orwell, from a very young age, knew or desired, so he knew that he wanted to and desired also to model himself as a writer on H.G. Wells. So you may know H.G. Wells, if for those of you who don't know who H.G. Wells is, very important writer who is responsible for some of the most famous, what he would call scientific romances, what we might call sci-fi novels, of the turn of the 20th century. So I'm thinking of things like The War of the Worlds, The First Men in the Moon, The Time Machine, The Island of Dr. Moreau. These are fantastic novels, very short books that can be read pretty quickly. Those novels, of course, held an interest for Orwell, but the novel that he was more interested in and that gave him the thing that he wanted to model himself upon was a book, not really a novel, but it's a sort of treatise of kind of fictional treatise by Wells called A Modern Utopia, which is published in 1905. And like Thomas More's Utopia of four centuries earlier, it's an account of a supposedly seemingly ideal society. Now, there are at least two ways that Orwell could be said to have been interested in this. The first, of course, is by inverting it. He's less interested in describing an ideal society and more in showing how a society assumed to be ideal or said to be ideal, namely Oceania, is in fact nothing of the kind and is, you know, falling well short of any announced principles of the ideal that it may once have had. So there's that. The other reason is slightly more formal, is to do with the style and structure of the book. And it's a very simple point, which is that Wells's text emerges from a dream. And so it's a sort of dream landscape. It's technically a kind of displaced sort of shift away from reality. You need to read the book really to get a sense of it, but it's a sort of dream landscape in which different possibilities come into view and are then dismissed in various critical ways. You could just about detect behind it the shadow of or the spectre of William Morris, So News from Nowhere, his utopian novel, also is the product of a dream within the story. And so Orwell is sort of tapping into that sense, I think, as a dystopian novelist, as a dystopian writer, that what he's trying to do is less predict the future and more show a dreamed alternative to the now, to his present, to his contemporary moment, through which he can express certain criticisms more effectively and more persuasively, more cogently, more engagingly, more passionately through fiction than he would otherwise have been able to do were his text a mere prediction of the future. This is not to say that there is not a great deal of intelligence and difficulty and sort of raw enthusiasm to be found in futurological writing, because that's not true. There is plenty of that. It's just that that was not Orwell's primary goal. He wanted instead to not be bound, I think, to the limits of prediction, and more to be opened up by the possibilities of persuasion. And he finds that in the dream form that he adopts for 1984. That's a big digression, but I think it's meaningful. And if you are interested to do this, it would be a very intriguing exercise. You could track dreams in the book in 1984. The appearance of the word, the occurrence of the phenomenon, so when people are dreaming, and then thinking more broadly about cognate or sort of related ideas like mirages or illusions or impressions, that kind of thing, or fantasy, and having a think about what it is exactly that Orwell is trying to do through those emphases. Anyway, end of digression. Let's get back to the text of the book. So where were we? He was trying, in other words, to put Julia out of his mind, and it doesn't really work. He can't. And they very quickly find a way to agree to meet. And then they agree to meet at Victory Square near the monument, in the midst of a crowd. And so they go to the monument, and it is a ceremony. It's a kind of a gathering to celebrate I can't remember what it is, actually. It's a procession, basically. It's to watch the arrival of captured Eurasian prisoners, and to sort of it's a sort of an extension of the hate idea that we see in the first part of the book. Winston and Julia meet in the midst of the crowd, watching what's in the novel is called the sad Mongolian faces gazing out over the sides of the trucks, utterly incurious. And in the midst of pretending to watch that procession and that sort of terrible ceremony, they agree to meet on a Sunday somewhere outside of the city, so outside of London, where supposedly it's safe. And so it proves they go off to meet each other. The next chapter begins with Winston picking his way up the lane through dappled light and shade, stepping out into pools of gold wherever the boughs parted. Under the trees to the left of him, the ground was misty with bluebells. The air seemed to kiss one's skin. It was the 2nd of May. From somewhere deeper in the heart of the wood came the droning of ringdoves. Now, I've read that out in a kind of affectedly literary way, because what I think Orwell is doing is drawing on a history of pastoral writing to really drive home the point here that the sequence of Winston and Julia meeting for their tryst, their sort of secret romantic encounter in the countryside, is the stuff of pastoral. It's away from the urban, it's away from the mechanical, it's away from the standardized, and it's into the personal, the natural, the green, you know, simply put. And it's important to do that because there's so few opportunities for Winston and Julia to encounter such things. They walk through the May sunshine. So the 2nd of May. So we're about a month after Winston writing for the first time in his diary, April the 4th, 1984. So it's, you know, the action has moved on fairly quickly. They feel dirty from having lived in London, but they They feel immediately refreshed and rejuvenated by being in the countryside. And Winston and Julia have a very odd, sort of stilted conversation where they look at each other and they're both burning with desire, although for different reasons. Winston's desire is very sort of sexual. Julia's desire appears to be more intellectual, so she's sort of curious about Winston, whereas Winston just basically just wants to have sex with Julia, and he wants to get that out of himself. It does eventually turn into something deeper, I think, something more meaningful, but at least at first it's very much in those terms, or at least presented in those terms. And there's this weird exchange where Winston says to Julia, "Now that you've seen what I'm really like, so sort of in the cold, harsh light of a natural day, can you still bear to look at me?" And she says, "Yes, easily." Winston replies, "I'm 39 years old," as if that's sort of disgustingly old. "I've got a wife that I can't get rid of. I've got varicose veins. I've got 5 false teeth." And Julia replies, "I couldn't care less." Orwell had a thing for 39-year-old men. They're often present in his books, just as a short aside. You know, he didn't live particularly much longer than that, so he may have just been feeling his age, who knows, and feeling that his body sort of failing around him. Anyway, they talk, Julia, Winston, they talk about different things. They talk about how they exist in the world. They talk about what do they do? They talk about how to get hold of illegal material, so sort of illicit stuff, scent, chocolate, that kind of thing. They, as I say, they're burning with desire, and they variously kind of fall into each other's company, and then they are brought up by the sight of a bird landing on a tree branch. And the sight not only holds them, sort of captivates them, but also holds us, the reader. So this is in chapter 2 of part 2. And there's this long paragraph where the detail of the thrush that alights on a bough not 5 meters away from them, almost at the level of their faces. A great deal of space is paid to this. Perhaps it had not seen them. It was in the sun, they in the shade. It spread out its wings, fitted them carefully into place again, ducked its head for a moment as though making a sort of obeisance, I've never been sure how to pronounce that word, to the sun, and then began to pour forth a torrent of song. In the afternoon hush, the volume of sound was startling. Winston and Julia clung together, fascinated. The music went on and on, minute after minute, with astonishing variations, never once repeating itself, almost as though the bird were deliberately showing off its virtuosity. A little bit further on, for whom, for what was that bird singing? No mate, no rival was watching it. What made it sit at the edge of the lonely wood and pour its music into nothingness? And so on. The reason that they find it fascinating is that this is a bird doing something for its own sake, not for some greater purpose, i.e. the further sort of glory of Big Brother or something like that, or as part of a party-ordered mandate. It's not doing it for those reasons. It is just being itself. It is doing what birds do. Birds fly around and they sing. And there's a sort of joy in that singing because they are complete, this is maybe an unnecessarily complicated way of putting it, but they are completely coincident with themselves. They are entirely themselves. There is no knowledge, no outside self-reflective, self-critical knowledge of themselves. They are just doing what they do. And there's an innocence and an enviable innocence to that for Julia and Winston. This is quickly followed by a sex scene. Julia and Winston have sex, and they then, in doing that, have, as the novel puts it, struck a blow against the party. They've made a political act. They, in a way, have done what the bird does. They've done something for its own sake, for their own pleasure, and not for any greater purpose. And in doing that, they have done something insistently, deeply, unmistakably political. How effective it is, who knows? And if you've read the rest of the book, you'll know that it's not particularly effective, but at least the intent is there. The drive to do something that is not recuperable within the logics of Oceanian ideology is there. They quickly realise that they can't really go back to the place more than one more time. So they can't go back to that glade, that sort of pastoral glade, more than once. They'll have to change where they encounter each other continually in order to avoid being detected by the Thought Police. And it says a little bit further on, as it happened, they never went back to the clearing in the wood. During the month of May, there was only one further occasion on which they actually succeeded in making love. That was in another hiding place known to Julia, the belfry of a ruinous church, in an almost deserted stretch of country where an atomic bomb had fallen 30 years earlier. So we are shown another bit of world building there, namely that there were atomic wars in the past of Orwell's imagined future, and that this is, you know, one of the signs of the profound difference between the present and the past, namely that it has passed through a nuclear conflict or conflagration. We learn more about Julia. We learn more about Catherine as well, Winston's wife. And one of the things that is introduced to us in this passage is something that, again, is relevant to what we were just talking about. Julia says that when you make love, you're using up energy, and afterwards you feel happy and don't give a damn for anything. They, the party, the state, can't bear you to feel like that. They want you to be bursting with energy all the time. All this marching up and down and cheering and waving flags is simply sex gone sour. If you're happy inside yourself, why should you get excited about Big Brother and the 3-year plans and the 2 minutes hate and all the rest of their bloody rot, as she puts it? Orwell is acutely alert to the fact that doing things for their own sake, doing things for individual personal pleasure within some kind of loving context, or even just a passionate context, not even a loving one, just a sort of one driven by urges that are personal with one other person, do not serve the state. They do not serve greater interests. That's where their value lies. That's why they're so precious and to be treasured. But for those ruling Oceania, they are to be mistrusted and to be stamped out. They should not occur, because that energy, as Julia knows, needs to be transformed, as the novel puts it, into war fever and leader worship. Let's move on a bit. We are coming up for about halfway through the time I'm taking, and I'm not anywhere near halfway through part two. So what I think we might do is move on just a little bit faster. We learn, obviously, lots about Winston, Julia, the world, what they think about it in chapter four of part two, which shows the reader Winston and Julia in the room above Mr. Charrington's shop. There's a lot of detail there about, you know, what's available to them in the world of Oceania. There's great amounts of interest in it. And the paperweight, of course, increasingly occupies the talismanic role that it has in the book. And there's this, at the final part of that chapter, you have Winston looking at it and thinking about it. He says he turns over towards the light and lay gazing into the glass paperweight. The inexhaustibly interesting thing was not the fragment of coral, but the interior of the glass itself. There was such a depth of it, and yet it was almost as transparent as air. It was as though the surface of the glass had been the arch of the sky, enclosing a tiny world with its atmosphere complete. He had the feeling that he could get inside it, and that in fact he was inside it, along with the mahogany bed and the gate-legged table, and the clock and the steel engraving and the paperweight itself. The paperweight was the room he was in, and the coral was Julia's life and his own, fixed in a sort of eternity at the heart of the crystal. When anybody ever says that Orwell is not a writer capable of writing beautiful stretches of prose, I always think of moments like that, because that to me is just, it's just great. I love it. Syme disappears in the following chapter. So Syme, I skipped over this in the previous episode, the fellow outer party member with whom Winston has a conversation in the first part of the novel about Newspeak and the progress, the development of the Newspeak dictionary. He notes there, or we're shown that he notes, that Syme is too intelligent for his own good, and that he is one of those people who, precisely because of that too good intelligence, will be destroyed, will be vaporized. And so it proves. He goes, he disappears. How does Winston know this? Well, he sees that a notice, a printed list of the members of the chess committee, of whom Syme had been one, has been altered very subtly. It looked almost exactly as it had looked before. Nothing had been crossed out, but it was one name shorter. It was enough. Syme had ceased to exist. He had never existed. Now, of course, Winston remembers Syme. He knows that he did exist. So he is not a good practitioner of doublethink. He is not able to seek to erase the memory of Syme from his mind, and then, having erased the memory, to erase the act of erasing the memory, and therefore completely to forget about not only forgetting Syme, but also that Syme had ever been there. Winston does not do this. He's not able to do it. He has no interest in doing it. And one of the dream logics of the book is that the Thought Police know this about him. Quite how they know this about him, of course, is another matter. There have been some very interesting efforts to try and think through exactly how the Thought Police gets inside Winston's head in the book. Some of them thinking about, you know, is he speaking in his sleep? Are the Thought Police telepathic somehow? Do they have access to some technology that allows them to read people's minds? Are they telepathic? You know, are they able to do that? In some ways, that misses the point, which is that, as I've already said, the book is a dream novel, and it doesn't matter in dreams how things happen. It's more that they do happen, and one has to work out what one thinks about it, and you know, what one does with that information. So in that sense, at that level, it doesn't matter how the Thought Police know about Winston. What matters is that they do know what Winston thinks, and therefore that they have power. Winston and Julia continue to meet. They continue to enjoy each other's company, each other's bodies, each other's minds. We are shown more world building. And then we get to a very interesting chapter, which is chapter 6. And this is where Winston and Julia meet O'Brien in his apartment. This is not chapter 6. This is it's a bit later than that. Apologies, that's my mistake. It's not chapter 6. Chapter 6 is where O'Brien makes first contact with Winston. That's what chapter 6 does. And he makes contact with him in the form of pretending to take an interest in Winston's ability to write Newspeak. What he's actually doing is setting up a meeting with him at his apartment, to which Winston and Julia subsequently go. And let me just skip to that, because I think that we can talk of more interest about that bit. It's chapter 8. So chapter 8 of part 2. They had done it. They had done it at last. They are standing in the inner sanctum, or one of the inner sanctums of the party, namely O'Brien's apartment. And one of the things that marks it out as incredible for them is that O'Brien is able to turn off his telescreen. Whereas Winston and Julia are unable, as ordinary outer party members, to escape the sound, the babble, the unending stream of sound and music and noise that comes from the telescreen. He is able to turn it off. He is able to escape from it. And this shocks them. It shows his privilege. It also maybe suggests something about his untrustworthiness, because he's, you know, as in a signal that they might have paid better heed to, because he's interrupting the rules of the game. You know, you're not meant to be able to turn off a telescreen. So it is a sign of privilege, yes, but it's also, I think, a warning. He exists outside of the system. He's not a product of it or limited by it. He defines the system. He is the rule maker, not the rule follower. And this should be a warning sign to them. they're not able yet to take it as a warning because they're too seduced by the power that this man has. And he ostensibly recruits them into an organization called the Brotherhood, which is supposedly the secret organization organized by Emmanuel Goldstein, the unrelenting figure of hatred in the 2 minutes hate sequences, that is responsible or will be responsible ultimately for destroying Big Brother. And they are sort of shown, or told rather, by O'Brien that their life in the Brotherhood will be mean and meager and unsafe, and that there's no guarantee that they will be able to do anything effectively. In fact, there is the better probability, the more likely thing to occur to them is that they will be captured and tortured. He's kind of laying out what will happen to them. And it may be, in some sense, another way of reading this sequence, actually, is that he's testing them. He's saying, you know, listen to me. I'm telling you what might happen because we both know what you're up to. And it may indeed, well, will be what happens to you shortly after we part company. This is your last chance to become good Oceanian citizens. You know, there are ways in which that's probably unlikely that to have been Orwell's intention. But you can kind of see how an adapter, for example, might use a moment like that to do something interesting with the moment. Either way, whatever they do, they are unlikely to live long because they will nonetheless need to be quote unquote cured by the system. So, you know, they're still doomed, but it may be that he was trying nevertheless to give them a sort of a way out. And there's a lovely moment at the end when O'Brien, before Winston and Julia depart, he holds out a hand. He wants to shake Winston's hand. It may be meaningful that he only wants to shake Winston's hand and not Julia's hand. But we read, his powerful grip crushed the bones of Winston's palm. At the door, Winston looked back, but O'Brien seemed already to be in process of putting him out of mind. He was waiting with his hand on the switch that controlled the telescreen. Beyond him, Winston could see the writing table with its green-shaded lamp and the speakwrite and the wire baskets deep laden with papers. The incident was closed. Within 30 seconds, it occurred to him, O'Brien would be back at his interrupted and important work on behalf of the party. I'm reminded there of that moment in The Godfather Part 2 when Al Pacino's character, the Godfather, kisses his brother Fredo and says, "I knew it was you." And he's saying, you know, "I knew you betrayed me," and seals his death warrant, Fredo's death warrant, in the process of doing that. This is a similar moment in some ways. O'Brien, it's not a friendly handshake. He crushes the bones of Winston's palm. I think he's announcing to him, you know, your end is nigh. This is only going to go one way. And that although this is, on the face of it, a sign of solidarity, it's the sign of friendliness, maybe, you know, as handshakes are often meant to be. This is not the case. This is the confirmation through a handshake of the doom that awaits you, the pain that awaits you, the brutal torture, the crushing of his soul, spirit and body that will come. Something I've never done, actually, is think about how often that word crush appears in the book. It may not, I don't know offhand, I've never tracked it, but again, something interesting to do. As an aside, and this would be a comment aimed particularly at undergraduate and secondary school students, to those of you who are listening, one way to really get yourself inside a book is to track the appearance of a word or concept through it. And in some ways, the less seemingly relevant, the better. Because it's very easy to sort of switch off your mind. If you were to track, so for example, something like surveillance through 1984, though a very important and obviously fundamental aspect of the text, it's kind of everywhere and hard to know in some ways what you can do with that, except to say that it's important. If you were to track something like grease, as in sticky, fatty substances, you know, grease, G-R-E-A-S-E, not the country, Greece, but grease, you know, the substance the imprint of the substance through the book, you'd find some interesting ways of thinking about the book and coming at it from different parts, different sort of narrative parts of the book. The same would be true of something like crush or crushed, crushing, the work of a crusher. What occurs? What is crushed? What is flattened? What is destroyed? It will just give you a very different way of thinking about the book. And in a sense, it's a kind of purposeless thing, but it will. But it has a deeper purpose, which is often the immersion in a text that has no end goal in sight is the one that allows you to think about it most innovatively and most creatively, because you're not looking for one thing in particular other than the thing guiding you through it. And you know, those are some possibilities. After that sequence with O'Brien and Julia in O'Brien's apartment, we learn that there's a great deal of preparation for Hate Week. Winston is very tired. He's gelatinous with fatigue, a great description of him. And then we get, finally, to the bit that I mentioned a little while ago, which is the bit that a lot of people skip. The reading, because O'Brien has given him it, of The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism by Emmanuel Goldstein. And this occupies quite a chunk. You know, it's in one form or another, you're reading the extracts for the best part of 30 pages or so of the text. So it's a not insignificant, it's about a tenth of the book. You know, it's a not insignificant stretch of prose. And this is another reason why it's strange to skip this part of the book, because you are missing out on so much of the novel if you do. You know, however tedious one may find it, it's there is a great deal there. Now, I've put this in terms of finding it tedious, finding it boring, skipping it because it's difficult or whatever. That's a very negative, defensive way of putting things. I personally find it fascinating, this part of the book. Yes, it's drier than the prose that surrounds it. It's technical. It's sort of historiographical. It's written in the manner of a textbook rather than a novel. But there's no reason why textbooks necessarily must be uninteresting. You know, that does a great deal of disservice to the writers of textbooks, of which there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands in the world. It does a job of work. It tells you a great deal about why it is that the world is the way that it is in Oceania in 1984. You know, I'm not going to go through it point by point, because in a way we've covered a lot of the material already. One criticism, I suppose, of the way Goldstein's book fits in a sort of awkward way into 1984 is that Orwell did not find a way more naturally to fit this information into the narrative more generally. I have some sympathy with that point of view. It does in some ways feel like a kind of information dump. If you're familiar with Tolkien, if you're familiar with The Lord of the Rings, a very similar criticism is often made of two chapters from The Fellowship of the Ring, from the novel. The first is The Shadow of the Past, which is where Gandalf turns up at Bag End and basically tells Frodo the whole history of the ring. And then the other bit, which does similar work, is The Council of Elrond. Those two sequences are sometimes and have been criticized for being sort of huge information dumps, where you're trying as the author to get an enormous amount of material across that's necessary for the reader to have at their fingertips, but you maybe didn't find some other way to incorporate into your story. And as I say, there's some sympathy with that. You know, I could imagine a different way of writing 1984 where this wasn't the case. The problem, though, is, I think, twofold. One is, on the one hand, Orwell is doing this world building, as we've seen throughout. So it's not that he's unaware of this. It's not like he, you know, tried to do it and then realized that he couldn't and thought, oh no, the way to do it is to just stick in a slice of Goldstein's book and that'll do it for me. That seems not to be the case, because he's already alert to the need to do world building, and that proceeds right from the start of the novel, and it occurs on almost every page. So that's not right. So the other problem with it, I think, is that criticism of the book, and this would apply also to Tolkien, I suppose, is that what's happening here is the depiction of reading. We mustn't forget that this is not just information given to us because we need it. It is Winston reading this information. So we have to imagine and to keep in mind the sight, the thought, the prospect of Winston sitting behind this text, this long stretch of text from Goldstein's book, and reading it and trying to imagine how on earth he never could have had this information to hand in the first place, and therefore what it means to him. And one of the things that it means to him is that it speaks to him across time. So after the first stretch of text that that Winston reads, we get a lovely paragraph. In my edition, it's page 208, where we're told that the book fascinated Winston, or more exactly, it reassured him. In a sense, it told him nothing that was new, but that was part of the attraction. It said what he would have said if it had been possible for him to set his scattered thoughts in order. It was the product of a mind similar to his own, but enormously more powerful, more systematic, less fear-ridden. The best books, he perceived, are those that tell you what you know already. And so we need to remember that this is, you know, personally meaningful for Winston to read this, that it sort of gives him a sense of someone else knowing what he knows and speaking to him across time and space. And there is a link, I think, to a later bit of the book, and I'm skipping ahead now. This is to part three, which will be the focus of the next episode of this little series of reflections, where Winston is looking at O'Brien in the torture sequence, and we read the following. O'Brien was a being in all ways larger than himself. There was no idea that he had ever had or could have that O'Brien had not long ago known, examined, and rejected. His mind contained Winston's mind. So in a sense, the fact that O'Brien writes, or is said to have written, Goldstein's book is perfectly pitched as a novelistic strategy, because Winston already feels spoken to by Goldstein's book before he knows that O'Brien is meant to be the author of it. And, you know, rightly so, justifiably so, because Winston's mind, his intelligence, is set up within the parameters of O'Brien's, and therefore there is a great deal of similarity between them, because what the novel is encouraging us to think and to accept through its dream logic is that O'Brien sort of contains Winston within himself. They're doubles. They are a pairing, and they are a pairing that are sort of fated always to be in some kind of connection with each other. Where are we? Let's think. One little point of detail, just before we get on to chapter one, Ignorance is Strength, i.e. the next stretch of stuff from Goldstein's book, Winston notices the clock, and the clock's hand said 6, meaning 18. And if you turn back to the opening sentence of the book, where it says, let me just read it, it was a bright cold day in April and the clocks were striking 13, we know from such a detail, therefore, that it means 1 p.m., not that there are 13 hours in some different system of organizing time. It's more that this society is run on military time, and that they use the 24-hour clock. And it's sort of more appropriate because of it, because it's militarized as a society. So the next stretch of text, which from Goldstein's book, which takes us up almost to the end of this part of the novel, is... So the first bit is concerned with sort of war and what the superstates, Oceania, Eurasia, and East Asia, are trying to do by being in conflict with one another. The second stretch that Winston reads is sort of more information about these things and the doctrines of the various states, but also it's concerned with what a hierarchical society means, and you know, how it might last and exist, how party members live from birth to death under the eye of the thought police. A party member, for example, is expected to have no private emotions and no respites from enthusiasm, which takes us right back to what Julia says about sex in the earlier part of this part of the novel that we've already spoken about. He, the ideal party member, is supposed to live in a continuous frenzy of hatred of foreign enemies and internal traitors, triumph over victories and self-abasement before the power and wisdom of the party. So love, for example, and certainly sexual love, is firmly suspect, is definitely to be outlawed, because that is a private emotion. and it is a respite from the kinds of enthusiasm that the party expects and demands of its constituent citizens. We are also shown the meaning of doublethink. There's already been a reference to doublethink in the book, and we already know what it is, but here we are shown sort of its operations. And one of the operations of it is confirmed, my edition, page 224, says, "It need hardly be said that the subtlest practitioners of doublethink are those who invented doublethink and know that it is a vast system of mental cheating." The closing sight of O'Brien as Winston and Julia leave his apartment, as he's sort of forgotten about them and is turning back to do his day's work, and the fact that he can turn off the telescreen, all those sorts of things, it aligns him with those who know that the system of Ingsoc, of Oceania, is a vast system of mental cheating. Later in the book, we see him, O'Brien that is, deploy doublethink when he's showing Winston the photograph of Aronson, Rutherford and Jones in the torture chamber, and he says, you know, he has the photograph in his hand, he destroys it, and he says, "I do not remember it." And there's a paradox there, because you can't say that you don't remember something in a sense without remembering the thing that you're meant to have forgotten. So when you say, "I do not remember it," what is the it? It sort of suggests that he's still aware of it. But the operations of doublethink mean that he has not only forgotten the thing, the photograph, but also the act of forgetting. So there's a lot of information about that. And then Winston becomes aware of silence as one becomes aware of a new sound, and it seems to him that Julia had been very still for some time past. She was lying on her side, naked from the waist upwards, with her cheek pillowed on her hand, and one dark lock tumbling across her eyes. Her breast rose and fell slowly and regularly. And the reason for this, of course, is that she's asleep. He's put her to sleep through reading. Now, there is a line of feminist critique here which says that Julia is sort of, we are meant to understand her as being inadequately intelligent to understand the, you know, the rigors, the intellectual rigors of Goldstein's book. And maybe, I don't know, what seems a more intriguing possibility here for me is that she's bored by Winston's reading of the text. And that there is a, and this may be, I don't know, a clever way of circumventing the point. I'm not sure. You know, I'll happily be challenged on this, but I just wonder whether it's less about making Julia seem unintelligent and more about making Winston seem less heroic than he perhaps wants himself to be. It may also be that she knows all this already and therefore has no interest in hearing it, and he sort of soothes her to sleep, as it were, by reading it. Who knows? There are different possibilities at the very least. They sleep, they recover, and then they look at the prole woman outside putting the laundry out, and one of the things that is sort of suggested to us here is that Winston certainly finds the sight of her beautiful, and Julia does not. Julia sees her as unbeautiful or sort of lacking beauty. And one of the things that I think the novel is trying to do is align the moment of them looking at the prole woman with the moment of them looking at the thrush in the glade in the forest at the earlier point of the text. They're both doing things for their own sake, in a sense, that the thrush singing, the prole woman hanging out washing. It's not as naive and innocent, the prole woman's actions, because it's for a purpose. You know, she's looking after her family. She is caring for them by doing the household work. But at the same time, there is something there that Winston sees as profoundly important. And he is, in a sense, seeing her as a sort of mystical figure. And a further sign that they are aligned, the thrush and the prole woman, is that she sings. At the end of it, she was still singing. The mystical reverence that Winston felt for her was somehow mixed up with the aspect of the pale, cloudless sky stretching away behind the chimney pots into interminable distances. And until that happened, so in the end, their awakening would come, the proles. And until that happened, though it might be 1,000 years, they would stay alive against all the odds, like birds, passing on from body to body the vitality which the party did not share and could not kill. Winston sees the proles as desperately important, but there's not much content to them beyond what he, in fleeting moments in the novel, sees as their importance. The birds sang, the proles sang, the party did not sing. That's the sort of the line that clips the point. He says, "We are the dead," to which Julia replies, "We are the dead," followed by an iron voice behind them that says very peremptorily, very autocratically and sort of intolerantly, "You are the dead." And they spring apart, and the spring has been uncoiled, the trap has been unleashed. Winston's entrails seemed to have turned into ice. He could see the white all round the irises of Julia's eyes. Her face had turned a milky yellow. The smear of rouge that was still on each cheekbone stood out sharply, almost as though unconnected with the skin beneath. "You are the dead," repeated the iron voice. And then something that to me has always been a fascinating little detail. The narrator says, it was starting at last. And this is both a sign of fear, but also of kind of reformulated desire on Winston's part. He's been waiting for this to happen. He knows it's going to happen. He knew from the moment that he wrote in his diary that it would happen. He knew one day that men in black uniforms with iron-shod boots on their feet and truncheons in their hands would burst into whatever space he was in and arrest him. And that would be the end of it. They come in, they destroy the room, they smash the paperweight, and then Mr. Charrington comes in. But all of a sudden, Winston sees that he's not Charrington, that he is in fact a member, an agent of the Thought Police. It was the alert, cold face of a man of about 35. It occurred to Winston that for the first time in his life, he was looking with knowledge at a member of the Thought Police. And that little emphasis on knowledge is key, because the beginning of the next part of the book starts with a declaration of not knowing. He did not know where he was. Presumably he was in the Ministry of Love, but there was no way of making certain. So if we cast our minds back to the remarks I made earlier about how unchallengeably and sort of horrendously difficult it is in this society to know things for sure, because the standard mechanisms of verification have fallen away, namely collective agreement on things, a belief in records and the untampered quality of records, or in principle the untamperability of them, those sorts of things. You know, the sanctity of chronicles, the sanctity of the archive, that's all fallen away. So it's very difficult to know history and to know facts and to be sure in their facticity or their factitude, you know, their factness, to be it's very difficult to be sure about those things. There are few moments of absolute certainty, and one of them is precisely when Winston knows that Mr. Charrington has lied to him, that he's been duped, and that standing before him now is a powerful man who has no interest in preserving Winston. On the contrary, all he is there to do is to hand him in to the authorities, who will destroy him. And that is the substance, the main thrust of part three of the book. Part one sets up the story. Part two throws a spanner in the works. Part three resolves it. Part three brings it to a conclusion. And the conclusion that it brings it to is horrible. And we're going to spend a bit of time with that in the next episode of this little series. So thank you very much for listening. I will be back very shortly with the third part. So take care. Bye-bye.